Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. My name is Chase Dalton, and with me I have two excellent reporters from Defense News, Megan Eckstein, who is the Naval Warfare Reporter, with a focus on the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps operations, acquisitions, and budgets. And I also have Brian Harris, who is the Congress Reporter for Defense News, where he covers U.S. foreign policy, national security, international affairs, and politics. And we're going to be talking about AUKUS, which is a nice little acronym, AU for Australia, and then the UK for United Kingdom, and US for the United States, AUKUS, so nice little bit of branding there. And this is a big, you know, three-nation pact to develop some technology and some joint operations. And I'm going to let you, Megan, take it over from there and tell us a little bit more about the AUKUS pact.
Yeah, thanks for having us on today. So as you mentioned, AUKUS is a partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And the basic premise is that all three nations are looking at an increasingly belligerent China. They're looking at, you know, destabilizing forces in the Indo-Pacific, trying to understand how they can work together to create safety and security, not only for those three countries, but for their allies and partners in the region. So they came to this AUKUS arrangement, which kind of has two pillars. Pillar one focuses on submarines, and pillar two focuses on other advanced technologies. Pillar one is what we're talking about the most today. So there's this so-called optimal pathway that the leaders of all three countries have laid out, which basically says that by 2027, UK and the US are going to operate their nuclear-powered attack submarines from a base called HMAS Stirling in Western Australia. And to be very clear, these are not submarines with nuclear missiles. They are nuclear-powered submarines. They have conventional missiles on board. So we're not getting into nuclear weaponry here, but these are nuclear-powered submarines. So there will be a task group of American and British submarines operating out of Australia by 2027. Through those operations, Australian maintainers are going to learn how to work on nuclear-powered vessels, which is really helpful for them, because the next phase is that the U.S. is going to sell between 3 and 5 Virginia-class attack submarines to Australia. They will own these boats, they will operate these boats, they will maintain them all by themselves, obviously with assistance from the US and the UK, but it will be their fleet as sort of an interim solution. And then the final phase is that while all this is happening, Australia and the UK will be building brand new submarines. They're called SSN AUKUS. It's a design that leverages existing US and UK technology. And so both countries are going to build them, and Australia we'll have this brand new fleet of attack submarines starting in the 2040s. And so the idea is that today we can start increasing the presence of nuclear-powered attack submarines in that area of the world, even as they build up towards Australia having their own fleet down the road.
Awesome. That was a better summary than I could have given. And so right now, actually, AUKUS is up for debate in Congress, and there are a lot of political dimensions ranging from jobs to some secrecy and how we manage our secrecy and export laws. And so, Brian, can you give us the rundown on that?
Yeah, so obviously AUKUS enjoys broad bipartisan support, but of course the devil is always in the details. We saw a bit of drama this year about getting, I would say, 4 key authorizations that Congress needs to pass to implement AUKUS, both on the submarine pillar and also on what they call pillar two, which is advanced capabilities like hypersonics, quantum sensing, AI, that sort of stuff. Those issues have been resolved. I can talk about them more in depth, but all 4 authorizations ended up on the National Defense Authorization Act, which by the time this airs, Congress will likely have passed it this week. On the submarine stuff, a lot of the issues there had to do with the industrial base. These are 3 pretty clear-cut authorizations. The first would authorize a transfer of 3 Virginia-class submarines to Australia in the 2030s, as Megan talked about. That's pretty uncontroversial, but the Australians were very keen on getting that done this year because obviously they'll have to be investing a lot in the infrastructure they need to implement AUKUS. And they kind of were looking at that as a show of U.S. commitment. So that shouldn't have really been that controversial, but and it's not, but nothing is ever simple in Congress. And Senator Roger Wicker, the top Republican on the Armed Services Committee, and these are very justified broad brush concerns, but he was concerned about the impact that transferring these submarines would have on the U.S. submarine industrial base. Because as Megan can tell you all about, the Navy is behind on its production goals. They want 2 Virginia-class submarines and 1 Columbia-class submarine per year. AUKUS will require them to slightly raise that number for the Virginia-class submarines we're transferring. So basically, Senator Wicker was concerned about the failure to meet this capacity. And his argument was that you need more money in the submarine industrial base to make this happen. So unrelated to the NDAA, Congress is debating this massive defense spending supplemental, which is mostly aid for Ukraine and Israel. And in there, he got $3 billion for the U.S. submarine industrial base for AUKUS. But again, that's separate from the NDAA. So there's still a bit of complication here. Congress, it doesn't look like it's making a whole lot of progress on passing that Ukraine-Israel supplemental, which has a submarine industrial base money. So what the NDAA does, it says you are authorized to transfer these 3 Virginia-class submarines, but the authorization doesn't take effect to a year. So that gives people like Senator Wicker more time to pass this additional funding in the U.S. submarine industrial base. But again, these transfers won't take place until the 2030s. There are a couple other ones related to submarines that authorize the transfer of private sector Australian personnel to begin training on nuclear submarines. And another one that would allow the Biden administration to accept Australia's $3 billion contribution in the U.S. submarine industrial base. So altogether, they're pouring $6 billion additional dollars for shipyards like Electric Boat in Connecticut, for instance, to build the submarines. On the second part, there was a bit of a tussle with the State Department on export control reform, the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations, ITAR. The Australians in the UK, this predates AUKUS for at least, you know, like 2 decades. They've been asking for blanket ITAR exemption, sort of like what Canada has. But the State Department, which oversees ITAR, has been hesitant to do that because they're worried that if the UK and Australia don't have export control regimes that are up to par with us, then, you know, countries like China, which has stepped up its espionage efforts on the Australian defense industry since AUKUS started, could take advantage of that. And this actually happened with Canada. China did this with Canada in the 90s, which caused Canada to temporarily lose that status. But anyway, what the NDAA says for that is that Britain and Australia will get an exemption to ITAR if they boost their own export control regimes, which at least the Australians are working on doing right now. And the reason why they feel this is so important, because a common complaint among the defense industries in all 3 countries is that the U.S. export control regime basically hinders American companies from collaborating closely with the Australian and British companies. And the idea of AUKUS beyond the submarines is to kind of stitch all 3 defense industrial bases together. So they look at that as necessary to implementing that pillar of the agreement.
So you brought up 2 points that I sort of want to hit on a little bit more. The first is we're building currently 1.2 Virginia class, and that is our, you know, state-of-the-art modern attack submarine. So we're building 1.2 of those a year. We want to build 2. We also need to build the Columbia class, which is our strategic missile submarine, right? So those are the ones that have nuclear weapons inside of them, and they shoot them off. They can go anywhere in the world. They're sort of the ultimate assurance that the United States does not get nuked ourselves. And so that's 3 submarines a year. We currently aren't even close to making this. And meanwhile, we're going to be transferring somewhere between 3 and 5 to Australia with a reasonable guarantee that they'll help us in time of war, but no actual guarantee. And so we're facing a drawdown in the submarine force as the Los Angeles class, which is the predecessor to the Virginia class, is getting retired, sort of the mid to late Cold War era attack submarines. And so I'd say that concern is, yeah, somewhat justified, right? How valid is that concern? How is that being assuaged? We talked about the $3 billion commitment, but I don't think money's the bottleneck here, is it?
It's a little bit money. It's a little bit other factors. So the Navy has found itself in exactly where it does not want to be with an acquisition program, where you have peaks and valleys in investments and buying something. So during the Cold War, they bought a lot of submarines. And then when the Cold War ended, there wasn't a very strong threat, and so the Navy stopped buying submarines, and now there's a threat again, and they're trying to ramp back up production. So to go from that low, you know, in the 1990s, early 2000s, up to where they're trying to go now, you have vendors that have gone out of business during that time. It's really difficult to get a new company stood up, certified to do business with the government, and sort of spun up to make these parts that they need for the submarines. A lot of companies that are still around have scaled down. And so workforce is a really big issue right now. There just aren't enough people who are trained to manufacture the components and the submarine structure that's needed. So the $6 billion plus potentially another $3 billion from Senator Wicker, plus what is likely to be another $3 billion that Australia will invest in the U.S. submarine industrial base. What this is getting at is a couple different buckets of things. One of it is training up more people to take on these jobs because there just aren't enough people to physically do the labor. Some of it's going after technology. There are robots. There's ways to automate work and just have a better process that gets the work done cheaper and faster. So there's sort of these process improvements. And then there's the facilities themselves. And one thing that's been really interesting to watch as the prime shipyards, so you have HII's Newport News Shipbuilding in Virginia, and you have General Dynamics Electric Boat up in Connecticut. So those prime yards are the only ones that are able to actually do the final assembly of the submarine parts, put it together, put it in the water, do the testing, and deliver it to the Navy. So that work has to be done there, but that workload is increasing. So they are pushing more work. Electric Boat has another facility in Rhode Island called Quonset Point. So particularly, they're pushing a lot of work to Quonset Point, but they're already at capacity too. So that means that Quonset Point has to push some of their manufacturing elsewhere. So they had done a lot of putting together modules that would get shipped, you know, to the main assembly yard. So what a lot of this money is going to is actually finding other places that have a lot of space that can assemble modules and then put it on a barge and ship it to the shipyard. So Austal USA down in Alabama is one example. A lot of money is going to helping them get set up. They have a huge shipyard. They have a lot of space to assemble steel and aluminum structure. And so they're using that space to help contribute to the submarine industrial base. So that's kind of some of the different buckets that the Navy is looking at for how to spend money to help increase the output of submarines.
Just to piggyback on what Megan said, especially about the workforce issues, you know, we've obviously been painting a somewhat dour picture of this, but there is reason for optimism. I know I was talking about Senator Wicker, who's very adamant that you need to invest billions of more dollars in the submarine industrial base. But, you know, on the flip side of that, Congressman Joe Courtney, who represents Electric Boat in Connecticut, which is the district where one of the districts these submarines are produced, is much more bullish. And he keeps citing the Navy saying that by 2028, they will at least meet their 2+1 requirements for two Virginia class one Columbia submarines. And from there, you just need to boost it to, I think, 2.2 Virginia class submarines per year. And on top of that, with Megan was talking about outsourcing to Austal, I was down there earlier this year for a non-AUKUS story. And one thing they told me there was that they're looking to hire 1,000 additional workers within the next year, I think, just for the submarine modules, which is obviously an ambitious goal. All those shipyards down there are competing for workers. But I think if they meet that goal, great. But the issue always comes back to just supply and demand with workforce, which money can only get you so far in that case. So there are reasons for optimism, but the basic core problems with the shipbuilding industry kind of seem to remain the same.
Right. And that's compounded horribly with submarines because there's a lot of specialty metals and such that are used in submarines that there is no civilian demand for. There's no demand, quite frankly, anywhere in the world for this specialty type of steel or whatever other alloy. And so it's okay, now do we expand this foundry to make? But you can't expand the foundry by 0.2. You have to double it. And that means it's twice as expensive and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of defense industrial base issues that we're looking at. But if we don't expand it now, then we have to expand it during wartime potentially, right? So it's how much to invest in having idle capacity now, vice later. It's a complicated problem, right? And, you know, money can get you somewhere, but money can't get you all the way. It takes a lot of planning. So the other aspect that I want to talk about initially was the ITAR aspect. So the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. That's a basically U.S. military stuff or dual use military civilian stuff export regime that is extremely onerous, and Canada has agreed to basically copy our export controls, but it sounded like Australia is coming around, the UK perhaps not so much. So what would that involve, both in terms of changing their laws, but also the enforcement thereof? And what is the internal resistance of those countries to not just being said, hey, we're going to do it?
That's a very good question. And I'll answer with the caveat that I'm not extremely well-versed in Australian or British politics. I know the Australian Parliament has begun working on this issue. And if they want that ITAR exemption, which they very much do, the law Congress is about to pass says they need to have comparable standards. But my understanding based on the law is the State Department has a fair amount of leeway as to whether they grant that to them. And this is coming down from the White House, which is very keen on AUKUS. So the Biden administration and the White House itself is very keen that there will be some sort of export control reform. It's just a matter of what the Australians and Brits have to do on their end to make that happen. I think some of the objections, at least with some of the defense industry folks I talked to, I think they feel like these export controls make it hard to work with their American counterparts. So like I talked to the head of an Australian company called Q Control, which is a tech company that's working on a lot of this Pillar 2 stuff. And even that has implications for the submarine part of the agreement. For instance, they're working on a quantum sensing technology as an alternative to GPS. And they're basically like, well, we have workers in the US and Europe, for instance, and our American workers can't effectively communicate with Australian workers because of ITAR. So that's one complaint. But on the flip side of that, it is a bit of a balancing act, because one thing proponents of ITAR, especially at the State Department, who are arguing that Australia and Britain need to step up their game, is in addition to Chinese espionage efforts or trying to acquire U.S. tech through third parties like the Australians, they'll point to, I think, as what they view as a compelling example, the case of Daniel Dugan, for instance, a former Navy pilot in Australia, who the U.S. wants extradited here for training Chinese F-16 fighter pilots, I think, in South Africa, or Chinese pilots to use F-16s, basically. And the U.S. wants him extradited, but it's working its way through the Australian court system. And one of the stumbling blocks that they found is that it's not entirely clear he committed a crime in Australia. So that's one example they point to of why they think ITAR and, you know, having our allies we share technology with have similar export controls in place.
Yeah, that you brought up that case. It's actually a fairly pervasive issue. You know, we've uncovered a lot of instances in which former pilots have been teaching basically NATO fighter tactics to the Chinese through various means. And there's a problem in Britain, you know, the Australians. I'm sure some American former fighter pilots have been involved, but they should absolutely be strung up for treason, in my opinion. But yeah, many, many, many of our allies have been so thoroughly penetrated by the Chinese, quite frankly, that that anything we share with them is more or less just being instantly shared with the Chinese. And so these are otherwise people that we would want to cooperate more with, and we can't. So
to tag on to that, the Navy obviously has a vested interest in getting these arrangements moving quickly, but they also have a vested interest clearly in keeping their technology secret. So even as there have been Australians who have come to the U.S., there have been Americans who have gone to Australia. NCIS actually already has something of a field office stood up at HMAS Stirling. So NCIS is there. The whole idea is to be on the lookout for any potential espionage, stealing of technology, just generally keeping, because again, it's nuclear powered submarines. And so that technology is very valuable, very highly protected. So they're already on the ground even before the submarines show up at Stirling.
Yeah, and that's a huge aspect of what the United States gets out of the AUKUS Pact, is we are ultimately going to be able to do maintenance and run fully fledged nuclear submarine operations out of Australia in a way that we previously could only do out of Britain and out of the United States. And so instead of the nearest submarine capable base being on the west coast of the United States, we now do this in Australia. Huge win in terms of being closer and having more repair facilities in the event of war, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to take a half step back, lay out what I see is what everyone gets from AUKUS, and you guys can fill in the gaps. In terms of what the United States gets, we tie the United Kingdom and Australia closer to us. And I think that that makes them both more likely to help us during a U.S.-China war, in which, quite frankly, we're going to need all the help that we can get. You know, two is that we can marginally spread the cost to our allies, Australia and UK, do some joint R&D development on those next gen technologies that we were talking about earlier, the quantum aspect, some of the cyber, some of the hypersonics, and the submarines, that we could eventually spread a little bit of that cost and make it more cost effective, get some economies of scale there. I just talked about the sub bases that we can operate out of. That would be awesome. And then our allies become more capable. So that's always good to have more capable allies. What the UK gets is really, we rescue their submarine industrial base. They are no longer a big enough and rich enough country to maintain a submarine industrial base based on their own orders. The Royal Navy is a ghost of what it once was. Two, to maintain that image of a special relationship with the United States, which is very important to them politically, but also from their security perspective. They put out an equivalent of their public strategy defense documents that they are incapable and are building their military on the assumption that they will never fight a major war without the United States. So maintaining that close friendship with the United States is important. And then lastly, since the UK economy has been an absolute shambles since their economically disruptive decision to leave the European Union, it's a jobs program for them, again, rescuing that submarine industrial base. And then Australia, finally, what they get some new technology, awesome. They get a survivable conventional second strike against China, awesome for them if they do want to pursue that strategy. They are edging a little bit closer to a U.S. NATO-style security guarantee that's a little bit stronger than the one they currently have. And then they got out of a bad deal with France at the cost of a little bit of diplomatic uproar. What am I missing?
I would say one thing that the U.S. is very interested in is not only being interoperable with allies and partners, but we keep hearing this phrase interchangeable. They want to achieve interchangeability. Think about American F-35s operating off of a British ship. It doesn't matter whose F-35 it is. It simply matters that there is an F-35 up in the air collecting data, sharing it with the rest of the force. It was maybe unthinkable before to think about the submarine force being interchangeable, but now that's exactly what we're going to have. We're going to have Australians with Virginia-class submarines. We're going to have Australians with the same submarine, the SSN AUKUS, as the UK. And so that presents some really interesting opportunities when you look at the vast geography of the Indo-Pacific. Australia knows the northern approaches to the island better than anybody else. So why wouldn't you want them patrolling? They probably have a good idea of where the threat tends to be. They have a good ability to pair, whether it's UAVs, USVs, other unmanned vehicles, with the submarine force, with, you name it, one of our other intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance tools that they may have, pair all of it together to really have a good understanding of that water. I think they can probably do that in a way that the United States just doesn't have the capacity to do. So even though some of the concern has been the United States giving away three of its submarines, even when our force is so small, even if we had those three submarines, we were not going to be patrolling those waters. And I think there's an increasingly good argument to have submarines there. So I think sort of that interchangeability is a really good argument for AUKUS, and just having everybody with the same technology, but with their own geographical expertise that they're bringing to it.
So one thing in your reporting, Megan, that I read about is, and it rings true to me, I was in the nuclear program prior to getting out of the Navy, is the U.S. Navy has 70-odd years of building up expertise for this nuclear program, lots of regulations, lots of lessons learned, right? And obviously, we're going to share that with the Australians to the extent that we can. But a lot of that is just institutional memory that is very hard to get. To what extent is that a concern? How are we trying to like avoid that, given that Australia is going to go from zero to nuclear in 2-3 years?
Yeah, it's one of the big challenges the U.S. Navy is focused on. And this is why AUKUS has to be such a tight partnership and why some of these congressional measures have to be passed basically right away. As you said, the Navy has more than 70 years of working with nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and submarines. There's a four-star admiral whose entire job is to oversee the naval nuclear enterprise. This admiral interviews every single potential sailor and officer who's applying for a job working with naval reactors.
It's a very stressful process.
Yeah, And it goes back to Admiral Rickover, who began the program interviewing every single person who is going to be working with these. And so, you know, the Navy has very tight relations for a reason. It's a safety issue for the people working with the nuclear reactors. It's a safety issue for anybody who would be affected if something went wrong with the nuclear reactors. And so, as you mentioned, the Navy just has very strict regulations in place. Australia has none of this right now. And so part of the imperative of getting Australians to the U.S. for training, and it's actually already started, they've had a few sailors go through the Naval Nuclear Training Program down in South Carolina already, but they are running into some of these ITAR issues. And so that's why Congress is really trying to get this done right now. But they have sailors, they have civilians who are coming to the U.S., getting trained up in not only how to operate and how to maintain nuclear reactors, but also the regulatory piece. There's going to be some Australian civilians who are coming here and learning from the people in the United States Navy who do this, as well as, I shouldn't just say the U.S. Navy, it's also the Department of Energy. But there'll be people coming here to learn this. There'll be Americans going to Australia to help them set it up as well. But again, this has to be such a tight partnership because Australians will be doing repair work on nuclear-powered submarines within like 4 years from now. And so, you know, it took us however many decades to stand this up. They have 4 years before they're going to be doing nuclear-powered work in Australia. So really, time is of the essence when it comes to some of these regulatory changes that are needed so that we can start training these folks right now.
Yeah, to me, that is just such a foreign concept that we would allow another country's people to so much as enter the reactor compartment of our ships and do maintenance on them. That is such an unbelievably high level of trust that we are working to build and verify, because having worked in reactor department, the only person not in reactor department that can come down there is the captain in the XO. And I mean, it's a very tightly controlled situation and very secret, no photography, no phones, no electronics, no nothing goes in there. And to allow another country's shipyard workers and sailors that level of access shows extraordinary commitment on our part to this alliance.
For whatever it's worth, for some color, I am not allowed as an American citizen, but as a reporter without clearance, I am not allowed inside the gates of a public shipyard that works, like does maintenance on these. There's a certain part of the gate where there's just office buildings, but then once you get past the next level of gate where the maintenance is actually taking place, I'm not allowed to step foot there. I've also been on an aircraft carrier during its refueling where they basically cut a giant hole down the middle of the ship to access the reactor. That way they can defuel it and refuel it for the next 25 years of life. I was really excited just to look down into this giant hole and see what that space looks like. And it was covered with a tarp that was marked classified. So if it gives you any sense of just how tightly controlled, like I can't even look at the hole where this goes.
So actually, speaking of these regulations under U.S. law that Megan was just talking about, one thing that I feel that's also interesting that's worth noting is China keeps raising AUKUS up with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which, of course, most people, I think, in the U.S. would be familiar if they follow the news with its work in Iran. For instance, it's basically the international non-proliferation regime. And China keeps raising this as an agenda item there, basically insinuating that it poses a proliferation risk, kind of insinuating that Australia is trying to start its own illicit nuclear weapons program, which I clearly have seen no evidence that's the case. So I think that's interesting in that it kind of shows that even though the US and Australia and the UK aren't specifically saying this is about China, it kind of shows how nervous China is about this agreement and the ongoing competition in the Indo-Pacific.
I mean, this goes directly into your angle, Bryant, where I think the US, in fact, is saying that more and more. I mean, 6 years ago, it was not the case. And I am not a fan of Donald Trump, but one thing that I do give him a lot of credit for is he said the quiet part out loud, and he caused what seems to me a fundamental political realignment of people no longer being afraid to say China, and not the Chinese people, the Chinese Communist Party is our enemy, right? They wish us ill, and they are playing a zero-sum game with us in which it is best not to lose these, right? They see this as a zero-sum game, and we need to adopt a whole-of-society approach to countering Chinese influence, which is malign for the long-term interests of the United States and therefore the long-term interests of the average American. If the Chinese get their way with many of the things that they're doing, the average American's quality of life and security will be lower.
Yeah, I would say there's definitely been, you know, as you noted over the years, especially in Washington, China has come up much more within policymakers, and they're veering more and more towards a very hawkish stance. You know, up here on Capitol Hill, for instance, you had the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party created this year, which kind of runs the gamut from arming Taiwan to deter a potential Chinese invasion to human rights issues like the Uyghur genocide, for instance. In something like AUKUS, certainly helps bolster their case for that.
Yeah, just for context on how quickly this has all changed, in 2016, so the U.S. Navy hosts a Rim of the Pacific international exercise every other year. In 2016, China came, they were invited, they participated in a very limited scope, but they participated in submarine rescue operations. Basically, the idea is that once a mariner goes to sea, they're all subject to the same dangers as each other. And if any mariner is in danger, anybody should be able to rescue them.
And to be clear, this rescue ship had a suspiciously large number of antennas and shit on it.
They did send some spy ships as well that were not invited, but they were invited to the exercise to participate in this limited scope. By 2018, they were officially disinvited. And so, yeah, these changes in political dealings with one another have changed very quickly.
Yeah. So the last sort of thing I want to talk about is the creation of a joint industrial base and some strategic friendshoring, offshoring, various terms for it. And that I think the war in Ukraine has shown some holes in our previous thinking that we can persist and strike our way to victory. And yeah, we could probably do that against the Iraqis or whatever in the Gulf War. But it turns out that we sort of do need that capacity to crank out a couple million artillery shells a month or mass produce ships. And a couple months ago, the 2023 China Military Power Report talked about, you know, the amazing rate at which China is producing ships, you know, about 30 in the last year, 15 of which were surface and 15 of which were submarines. You know, the vast majority of those were conventionally powered, so not as capable certainly as the nuclear. But one aspect of the AUKUS is really that co-production aspect, which hopefully will allow us to build up that joint industrial base, which, you know, I think that should we go to war with China, which I sincerely hope we do not do, that we will have the Brits and the Australians as our allies, because along with the Canadians, you know, truly our best friends that we have in the world.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, to start, I think it's unreasonable to think that Australia is ever going to build an entire submarine for the United States, but there are certainly ways that they can contribute. One of the things that the Navy is really leaning into right now is the idea of 3D printing certain components. As it turns out, 3D printing is something that Australian companies are very, very good at. So there is a center of excellence located in Danville, Virginia. They have a number of 3D printers and that are sort of experimenting with the best materials, the best processes to build some submarine components. And there's already an Australian printer there. So they are very much part of trying to get the technology into the U.S. submarine industrial base. But there is definitely interest in having them, yeah, Australian companies in Australia crank out repair parts, crank out parts for construction that could be shipped to the United States. So in that way, they will definitely be part of the U.S. submarine industrial base. And there's also a lot of interest when it comes to unmanned. We've seen a lot of American companies partnering with Australian companies. We've seen a lot of American companies setting up offices in Australia. There's just a number of really great AI and autonomy companies in Australia that have a lot to offer in this space. And so this is where Pillar 2 of AUKUS really starts to come in. But when you get into production, I mean, this is something that Australia is already doing. And if it were to be unmanned systems that we were looking to ramp up production, they're absolutely already the right partnerships to make that happen. And the last example I would give, maybe not artillery shells per se, but you know, there's already a number of weapon programs where the U.S. Navy and the Australian Navy are partnered. If you look at the torpedo program, that's one that's been done in conjunction with the Australians. And so very much an opportunity for co-production for things like that, as well as other future programs the Navy's looking at.
Yeah, because in the naval realm, artillery shells equals torpedoes and missiles. And during World War II, the big battles saw hundreds, if not thousands, of torpedoes shot at each other from, you know, little PT boats, from destroyers, you know, cruisers. Everyone had torpedo racks on every single available surface, as well as anti-aircraft guns. And you know, the modern equivalent of that is missiles and torpedoes still. And being able to produce a lot of those is going to be important one day.
Well, one thing I would flag is that I think the Pentagon's assessment is that by the end of the decade, China is expected to have a 440 ship fleet. And so there is, we obviously talked a lot about the workforce issues earlier. I think there is an understanding, well, I don't know if there is an understanding, but it seems like it will be difficult to outproduce China, whether you're talking about shipbuilding or anything else. So I think one of the things we've seen the U.S. moving towards in recent years, certainly under the Biden administration, is trying to more closely intertwine our industrial base with our allies to make up for this production gap that will always lag behind China, even in the best case instances. And one thing that's in the NDAA Congress is about to vote on and likely pass, that's kind of AUKUS related, but separate from the authorizations I was talking about earlier, is the U.S. Defense Production Act. It adds Australia and the UK as countries eligible for grants under the Defense Production Act. So these are grants that DoD gives to defense companies, and usually they're U.S. defense companies. To date, Canada has been the only country that's eligible for them. The NDAA will add Australia and the UK. And one of the ideas there is that the Pentagon office that oversees these grants wants to create these campuses on U.S. soil where the representatives from the defense industries of all these countries can collaborate together and work on things like all across the supply chain, whether that's energetics or microelectronics. And even if you go all the way down to something like critical minerals, which is something China also dominates, that we have problems with shortages and stuff. Cobalt, for instance, is very prevalent in Australia. So feasibly, you could use Defense Production Act grants now to fund Australian companies to open cobalt mines, which helps free up our reliance on those supply chains with China.
Well, that is a great summary of the AUKUS Pact. Again, that's the Australia, United Kingdom, US, AUKUS Pact that really is working to tie together the submarine and then the greater industrial bases of three very close allies. Everyone gets a little bit of something from it, and it'll be hopefully authorized by the time you listen to this. And I wanted to say very much thank you again. This is Megan Eckstein and Brian Harris, both working for Defense News. You can go and you know, Google their names and read anything. I'll put links to their brilliant series of articles back in September on AUKUS in the show notes, so you can go click on that in your podcast viewer. You can always email me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your opinions. I'd love to tell me where you think I'm an idiot. I do get plenty of those, and I nonetheless respond to everyone who sends me an email saying that I'm an idiot, explaining why I think I'm not an idiot. And occasionally I say, good point. You're right. I didn't think about that. So yeah, by all means, keep the emails coming. And until next time, fair winds, foul legs.